I'd like to just review a bit the historical perspectives on religious freedom and how it developed and over the years, leading essentially to the First Amendment and the Bill of Rights. Each of the previous documents that related to governance in the United States had some reference to religious freedom. The United States Constitution, when it's written, when it was written and during those months of May through September, I think it was in 1787, there wasn't mention of that, and there's quite a bit of criticism about that until they considered it in the Bill of Rights, which were adopted in 1791. Then I thought we might deal with some of the court decisions and maybe concentrate essentially on the textbook controversy or the decisions that related to the textbook controversy in Tennessee, the secular humanism debate coming out of Alabama with the decision by Judge Hand in the court there, and then the most recent United States Supreme Court decision on creation science evolution that came out of a case in Louisiana. That didn't happen to be the first consideration of that, and I'll review a little bit of that. And then maybe if we have time, we want to take time certainly for discussion, but if we have a little time, we might talk a little bit about some of the political ramifications, political aspects that relate to appointment of justices to the Supreme Court and the impact that has, and you trace the history of the court through time. But anyway, talking about the document, one of the, I take the Kiplinger Washington letter, because I find it's really a quick summary of what's going on around the country in some parts of the world. But on June 26th, Austin Kiplinger wrote as the editor and publisher, "The 4th of July is coming up, a good time to reflect on 200 summers ago." And when we arrived here last Saturday, of course, we had the July 4th parade. Some of you may not have been here for that. "The drafting of the Constitution, the basis of our form of government, when started as a move to relax trade barriers among 13 independent states, evolved into something that wasn't even imagined when the meeting began. There are two plans, the New Jersey plan and the Virginia plan, which I mentioned in a previous lecture. The New Jersey plan was essentially to amend the Articles of Confederation, make them better. The Virginia plan was substantially to change it, and they had a fairly good contingent. The men that came to that Constitution were very, very bright, intelligent men. I mean, they were some of the sharpest minds in the country at the time. Madison, of course, who was their brilliant young man of, I think, 35 or 36 years of age, kept notes on everything that happened during that during those months, and of course constitutes a marvelous background for our research. It has stood the test of political change, wars, social upheaval, a civil war which would have destroyed the governments of other nations, the rise from slavery, economic chaos in the Great Depression, civil rights conflicts, assassinations, Vietnam, and Watergate, and even now as we consider Irangate. It is a commitment to the rule of law, by no means perfect. Americans disagree on the powers of the Supreme Court, the Congress, and the White House, and the debates between May and September of 1787 were very, very heavy as it related to this distribution and the balance of powers between the executive, the legislative, and the judicial, and it continues to this day. But the Constitution has a special faculty for accommodating differences, for flexibility, permitting maximum freedom between competing interests, and for providing delicate checks and balances among the branches of government. And it is a living document as usable for the futures and the past. Now, some may disagree with that. I'll give you another little reference that did come out of the literature. My own feeling is that it is a living document, that it's malleable and to change. I mean, I think with the right kind of input and a more unselfish view on the part of all the people that make up these branches of government, we probably could effect some changes. But I take the Harper's Magazine, and one of the first parts of it in readings, celebrating the Constitution, a dissent. I had some comments by Justice Thurgood Marshall. I don't know how many of you read that controversy when it came out. Some people were quite upset. At the same time, he was reflecting a view, and I bring it up, I think, to some extent as it relates to our rainbow on the mountaintop, because with the potential appointment of a new Supreme Court justice, nominated now by President Reagan, this becomes even a little more controversial item as they develop the hearings to for the Senate to approve that appointment. It would be quite interesting for us. But anyway, this is quoting a speech from Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall, which was delivered May 6th in San Francisco. No, it was in Maui, Hawaii. The focus of this celebration invites a complacent belief that the vision of those who debated and compromised in Philadelphia yielded the more perfect union it is said we now enjoy. Thurgood Marshall then says, I cannot accept this invitation, for I do not believe that the meaning of the Constitution was forever fixed at the Philadelphia Convention. I don't believe it was either. Nor do I find the wisdom, foresight, and sense of justice exhibited by the framers particularly profound. To the contrary, the government they devised would be effective from the start, requiring several amendments, a civil war, and momentous social transformation to attain the system of constitutional government and its respect for the individual freedoms and human rights that we hold as fundamental today. Now, in other words, that's an opinion. And of course, at that time, there was really a terrible debate on, as it related to abolition and slaveholders and the holding of slaves. And of course, that constituted a very, very difficult problem for our founding fathers, many of whom did not believe in slavery, but to accommodate the so-called more perfect union, the Constitution could not have passed without accommodating that particular part of our country at the time. It is interesting in reading at the time that the Constitution was being considered there in Philadelphia. The Congress, of course, was also meeting. The Congress of the United States under the Articles of Confederation were also meeting. And they adopted at that time the Northwest Ordinance, in a sense, for the new states that were being formed. I had not really followed the... It's funny, when you get into the study of this, you start to realize some things about perspectives and time. You know, we're really a relatively young country. The Revolutionary War took a long time to be resolved from the Declaration of Independence on July 4th in 1776 until the Treaty of Paris. That came in, wasn't the Treaty of Paris, anyway, it was in 1787 as well. During that time, the Congress is meeting, the ordinance is being written for the Northwest because the war, for all practical purposes, has been over, and the officers and military men want to move westward and claim some of that land because with that the United States gained vast territories of land to the west. So, and I'll cite some ideas out of the ordinance because that's quite interesting. Then I thought there were just a few. The other thing I thought, that one of the papers in our area carried a series of the Constitutional Day Book, and they took every, are they doing that in some parts of the country in your area too? Yeah, it's kind of interesting. Do you enjoy reading them? I've enjoyed them just because they fit some of what I intended to do this summer. But the total cost to the federal taxpayers for getting the Constitution written was $1,586. I don't remember that. It's hard to realize with the vast volume of paper going through today, you begin to wonder what might have happened. Then they told about what the activities of delegates, and I thought it was kind of interesting that George Washington dined at Robert Morris's and spent the evening drinking tea at the home of Samuel Meredith, a Pennsylvania delegate to the Congress. And I thought that was some of the little things. It's interesting that congressional salaries at the time, during that time, have risen from $5 per day in 1789. Of a tremendous sum to now in about $80,000 or $90,000 of representatives get paid plus substantial budgets to run their office. But the other thing that appeared on June 10th that I thought was kind of interesting was they looked at Lutheranism in Philadelphia, and it's just purely a sidelight, but it's rather interesting that the tradition of Lutheranism in Philadelphia found its roots first in the Swedes along the Delaware River in the 1640s. And that followed, of course, the much stronger immigration of Germans prior to that time. And they talk about the family, Henry Melchior Muhlenberg, who arrived to serve the United Congregations of Philadelphia, New Hanover, and Trapp. And he brought organized church, in a sense, there as far as Lutheran is concerned. He's called the Patriarch of Lutheranism in that area. But it was just a little anecdote that I thought was kind of interesting because that became a very famous family throughout Pennsylvania. And one of the men was a major general of the Continental Army. Another became a speaker in the U.S. Congress, and then the other founded a college, first president Franklin Marshall College. I don't know, is that a Lutheran college today? No, I don't think it is. I think it's either an independent private college, but it's interesting because we know that one of our major bodies of the new church was centered in the headquarters of Philadelphia with probably the major a publishing company in the country. But I thought that just as I've enjoyed reading that series of articles as it's gone along. Well, let me now look at a little bit. The other thing that was interesting about, I thought about the Articles of Confederation that preceded the writing of our Constitution, and I suppose the reason it led to some of these changes in our own Constitution, the reason that they decided to rewrite it rather than to try and amend the Articles of Incorporation. But it required 100% ratification by all the states. There was no executive, and there was no system of courts. And I only mention that because it leads me to the fact that we'll deal essentially with the part of the courts. And since I want to deal essentially, I'll deal more with the school issues, the church-state issues that relate to school, since I have greater knowledge in that field than I will in some of the others, or some of the other very, very important decisions that were made. But I thought it might be interesting to look at the Northwest Ordinance as one. Well, the other one that is important too that I'd want to comment on prior to the adoption of that, the state of Virginia in 1784 thereabouts adopted in their particular legislature a bill that would allow support for a tax for Christian churches. And Madison was greatly disturbed by that. And so Jefferson was enlisted to write the Virginia Statute for Religious Freedom, which was adopted. And in that statute in 1786, we see the birth of the ideas which were then incorporated into the First Amendment of our Bill of Rights as it related to religious freedom. That was the first thing, as you remember, that was mentioned, was that there should be no establishment of religion, nor shall the free exercise be prohibited. So that is one. And then in the Northwest Ordinance, there's also a reference to education. And I think it's a rather interesting one, because that also held that there would be no slaves in any of the new states that were formed. And that was a significant move in July 13th of 1787, while the Congress, frankly, is still, or the committee, or the convention to write the Constitution is still meeting. In Article 3, religion, morality, and knowledge being necessary to good government and the happiness of mankind, schools and the means of education shall forever be encouraged. And that you'll find, in a sense, in the constitutions that are written throughout the country from that time. The schools shall be encouraged. I suppose the only interesting thing from a person who's been both in the public and private school situation, it did not define necessarily a system of public schools. That came in constitutions at a later time. All of the schools prior essentially were private church-related schools. They conducted the education, and some of the practices during that time did provide, in a sense, community help so that those schools could flourish at the time, or as much as possible to educate young people from the very beginning to really understand the scriptures and to develop their ability to preach. And with the great in-migration that comes in the mid-19th century, then we start talking about the massive growth of a public school system to accommodate the needs of this great in-migration from Europe. In Philadelphia, they started May 14, 1787, and concluded on September 15, 1787. And it just, there's a little note that I read somewhere. On September 17th, a clerk read to the assembled group the engrossed bill. And if you hear in the legislatures or Congress, you hear about engrossed bills. It's the writing of that bill in form that's presented to the legislative body. I did review in previous times the division of power, but the one that I think is quite important for our consideration of the discussion today is the basis upon which the judiciary was established. We talked the other day some on a question that was raised on presidential power. We talked about war powers, emergency powers, and so forth. The fact that the judiciary retained the right to exercise disputes between branches of government, as well as disputes that come out of particularly that area of the presidential war powers and emergency powers, because they've generally been highly political, that has not been exercised. But anyway, the article that relates to the judiciary is Article 3, Section 1. And there are one of the amendments, sections 1, 2, and 3. And all it really says, and this is a reason there is sometimes confusion on that too, the judicial power of the United States shall be vested in one Supreme Court and in such inferior courts as the Congress may from time to time ordain and establish. And then it talks about the holding of office for a lifetime. The one of the early amendments after the first 10 relates to judicial power, and that's Article 11. The judicial power of the United States shall not be construed to extend to any suit in law or equity commenced or prosecuted against one of the United States by citizens of another state or by citizens or subjects in any foreign state. Therefore, that led to the development of the state system other than to hear as it affects the United States Constitution. And that's essentially what we'll discuss to some degree today. Now, I'm not sure if you have any questions that relate to that part up to this time. Otherwise, I'll barrel ahead into the Bill of Rights, which was the next major area of our. I was going to look at a few things on the on religious intolerance, but we might talk a little bit about Article 1. I'll read it to you again because it helps to be heard, I think, at times. That first Bill of Rights, the first of the Bill of Rights, has been called the most important of all. It's what makes our government so distinctive, and most of the court cases, at least that relate to church-state issues, are going to be around that issue. And of course, some of the press issues and speech issues, the rights of assembly, and you can think of national press that's been directed to some of these areas. We will not have time to deal with the kinds of bills. We'll try to limit that. But Article 1 of the Bill of Rights states, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. Now what follows then are the other rights, the freedom of speech, press, right of people to peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for redress of grievances. That is essentially, but the part that we'll be dealing with mostly today is Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. It's called the two clauses. It's the one part of the Bill of Rights that has two clauses, establishment and free exercise. Now, the problem with that, nothing was done for about 140 years in the history of our country. And it took the 14th Amendment, in a sense, to implement those rights. Now, actually, the 14th Amendment had more to do with the 13th. What was the 13th Amendment? Abolition of slavery. And to make sure that those people had due process and could their rights. Now we've freed the people who've been bound in slavery for these many years since the founding of our country, 200 years or more. There was a need to make sure that they were given the rights of citizens. Now that, unfortunately, didn't happen in the way that it should have. It took a long time for us to develop the civil rights legislation. And so, well, I think it just that it takes people so long to fully implement a matter that had such great social impact. And it you'd think that it should have, the day after it was declared, it would have been effective. Now today, when you look at decisions that are made regarding the Supreme Court, now that's probably, it may well have been the Supreme Court that could have implemented much sooner. It took until 1954, for instance, for the desegregation of schools. And you think, sometimes you look at that and say, why did it take so long? In other words, this whole concept of separate but equal. And we could spend, I think, a good deal of time on that too. But because some of those rights were left to the states, and I think again to see if there's some way to bind up the union and hold it together, I think there were some, they didn't move as quickly as they should have. And it took, as I say, until then, and then you think 1963, it wasn't until 1963 that we had any significant civil rights legislation. And of course, even women's vote came, that's more the next, that's not, that's still quite a way after that. That was, let me see what year that was, I looked at that too. Well, that was in 1920. See, so I mean, here in 1865, we have passed the 13th Amendment, and the 14th Amendment comes in very soon after that. Let me check, I've got the dates on that too. I think it's just the natural inclination of people not to face up to a responsibility that I think moves faster and faster now with our means of communication and our ability to make changes more quickly, and also the fact that any other change at that time, movement was not resisted. In other words, today we would rise up with a strong voice to make the necessary changes. I want to look and see. Yes, Article 14 was 1868. So within 2 or 3 years, and of course it takes some time because you have to go through the states, 3/4 of the states have to make that ratification. But they did it. You know, it's interesting. In that sense, it's interesting they did it too. You'd think they would have resisted that. But then Article 19, the rights of citizens of the United States to vote shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of sex. Congress shall have power to enforce this article by appropriate legislation. There are a couple of other articles that, of course, have tremendous impact in our country, too. And Article 5, this whole idea of self-incrimination. And that's how you think of our most recent dealing with that issue, with the, I think the Watergate, and now Irangate, in which people have taken, and that was true also back in a time when they were on a communist witch hunt. You remember people invoked their Fifth Amendment rights. The other article that we have not looked at so carefully either is Article 9. The enumeration in the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people. I think that's always been a very interesting article in terms of my discussion with other people, in that, how do we affect those rights? And it's an interesting thing. I've often thought, in most states, you have a process of initiative or referendum by which you can actually change your state constitution. That's done essentially through our Congress, our House of Representatives, the Senate. Whereas at the state level, we do have a way of changing most of our state constitutions by a people's vote. And then the other one too, I think Article 10 also, the power is not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the states respectively or to the people. I think it's how we get the states' rights out. We had that very, very tremendous bargain. I've often wondered, since Article 1 was implemented, Articles 1 and 13 essentially were implemented through the 14th Amendment, I've often wondered about Article 9 and 10, whether there was not some way that people, that could have been amended to give people a stronger voice. And it may be a potential area. I'm not a constitutional lawyer, but it may be one of the areas in which some creative congressman or president or somebody else someday may look and say, is there a way that we could affect change that would give more power, in a sense, to the people, other than through the ballot? There are some places where in articles, I think the Republican form of government would be allowed our representatives to act for us. And but that's interesting. Well, let's move on a bit to the First Amendment and some of those. I wanted to give just a little background on that part of the thing. Now on religious freedom. I have one book by Isidore Starr that I've looked. Only have one little section, but it talks about the historic. There is a little graph in here on the historic road from religious intolerance to religious tolerance to religious freedom, and the court decisions sometimes appear. I mean, depending which side of the question you're on, appear to exercise increasing limitations on what some people would think is a religious freedom. The tendency has been in court decisions over the past many years to limit in terms of the Establishment Clause of the Constitution. In other words, you can deal with the establishment. There should be no establishment of the church. Some scholars have said they feel that was essentially centered around the idea that the Founding Fathers didn't want to establish, you know, a Catholic Church of America or a Congregational Church of America or a Lutheran Church of America with support, as we see it in, say, Norway, Denmark, and Sweden, which is familiar to me. But the establishment of a church as such, and I think the Religious Freedom Statute of Virginia spoke directly to the idea of taxing the people to pay for church support in Virginia, which I think makes that a truly seminal, significant document of the United States. Right. It's just like even North. I know a lot of people are not very happy with Colonel North, but geez, that's his protection. And if you were in that spot, and you would want that protection of the law. And of course, that was Jefferson, Madison, and those people. They were so concerned about the rights of the individual, which of course then leads us to the certain kinds of problems that we have today in the remnants of that rugged individualism, which was part of the development in terms of our colonial expansion westward and other parts of the world, which now has become, now it haunts us to some degree, because we are having to look had a whole new concept of community. And that's why I think this 200th anniversary and this discussion of the Constitution is so fascinating to me at the present time. Because we need to look, but still, again, I think in every case you want to be sure that an individual has a protection like that against any of the imposition of the government. I think particularly back in the McCarthy hearings. So just think of that terrible time. So we have a tendency, it was, thank God for it then, but now if it's a different circumstance, I think we are maybe a little more critical, so we have to be careful with that. But we make sure it's equally applied. That's right. That really is. I think so. And I still look at this, in spite of Thurgood Marshall and in spite of other critics of the Constitution, I can appreciate that feeling, because that was wrong. Slavery was wrong from the beginning. I mean, there's no way that we can justify that in any sense. And in my mind, I don't think there's any way. I don't think we can justify apartheid in Africa. We can't justify the discrimination that's considered today as Christians. But that's what I believe our Constitution has the protections built into it from the very beginning. And it still is a document today that can be changed to for that. But this when they, this little book gives a little graph, and it just talks about the theocracy in Europe to the theocracy in the colonies in a sense, of the Declaration of Independence. Some of John Locke's writing in England, of course, having a great impact on our founding fathers. And I indicated I put those essays on the bibliography. They're very ponderous, very difficult to read, but nonetheless, he had great influence on what was done. Then the Declaration of Independence in 1776. There's one person said that Jefferson took a good deal of time to write that. It's a rather long document. And he could have done it in two words. He said, "We quit," and that would have been sufficient to take care of our Declaration of Independence. And also the on then to the American Revolution, and the Virginia Statute of Religious Liberty, the Northwest Ordinance, the drafting of the Constitution, and then the ratification of the Bill of Rights. It's essentially that historical, those steps in getting us to the point we're at today, and we're still then debating that issue. Now, there are some, there are three issues that I thought I would like to discuss, and Martha McCarthy does have a nice section in here on alleged establishment of religion, the religion of secular humanism, and in spite of, I think I'll let the textbook controversy go. But I've invited one of the professors at New York University to the Northwest next fall to talk about this area. It's a Dr. Paul Vitz out of New York University. And Dr. Vitz has done a lot of writing. Do you know Paul Vitz, David? Yeah, of him. You've probably read his material. But he was instrumental in all of these things that relate to the textbook controversy. He's done a good deal of research on the writing of textbooks, particularly in the last decade or so, in which virtually the religious influence in the founding of America is just left out. Even when there's a discussion in the history of the textbook of Martin Luther King Jr., it may not include the fact that he was a Baptist preacher. And you read the Articles of Confederation, the Declaration of Independence, and you realize that there was a strong reliance on God the Creator and the author of the universe and so forth. But that is pretty much left out of textbooks that come along today, and relates also to the secular humanism and the creation science of evolution controversy. And those are very closely related. But, yeah, go ahead. Well, I'll talk a little bit about it. If you want to add to it, what I was worried about, we may not have enough time to get to. I'd like to. So I'm glad you're here. Well, that's the. I know those people. That's that accelerated Christian education curriculum. And, what's the name? Tell the name of Don. I can't remember his name, but some of it comes out of the idea that this man pulled together all of the programmed learning materials that have been developed under public school auspices. He took sequences of information and at the time felt that it was not adequately reflective of the Christian position. So what they did is they did all these program materials and put in very strong strong religious orientation, almost like a McGuffey reader, only it was programmed. And some people are now redoing the McGuffey readers and putting them in some form so they can be used. And the people associated with that textbook case in Tennessee would grow out of that tradition. And what they felt is that their children were being taught with textbooks that did not reflect America's religious heritage, and very little mention or comment that related to it. And I think they probably were true. Dr. Paul Vitz, in whom I have a good deal of confidence, is correct. They left it out. I have some comments on that that relate to the the current writers of that. It is interesting, a young man from Washington was the attorney that argued that case. And he was out of Olympia, and he and his wife homeschool their children, very fundamentalist. It's rather interesting, his father is a public school principal in Washington, too. But he's grows out of a very strong tradition of a more fundamentalist view of Fanon. Well, that's another group in this major publishing company out of Texas that supplies materials throughout the world. It's a vast enterprise. I'm trying to think that accelerated Christian education curriculum. Because people are, a large majority of people are seeking them. In other words, you have a large group of people who are looking at it as a protective kind of thing, too. And there was a Supreme Court decision that protected a minority of people with a strongly held religious belief. Remember the Yoder, Wisconsin case that related to the old Amish, maybe from Wisconsin. Besides the 1925 case, Society of Sisters versus Pierce in the state of Oregon, which established the right of parents to send their children to a private school. The influence in Oregon of some very extreme people indicated that all children had to attend public school in Oregon. And of course, the Society of Sisters, a Catholic group, contested that and went all the way to the Supreme Court, and they ruled that in 1925. The second case that was decided was the Yoder versus Wisconsin, a case of Amish who chose not to educate their children in public schools after the eighth grade. In other words, they believed that the time after eighth grade was to be done in vocational, in the ways of the community. What makes that case interesting, there's never been a decision that relates to the elementary level, in some sense. There are some great controversial cases in North Dakota and South Dakota regarding parents who homeschool their students, parents who enroll in not approved private Christian schools. Now, many states in the Union do not have the requirement that private schools be approved, so that has created a controversy in some states. Now, the textbook controversy will go on up. It may or may not go on up. I have some periodicals that tell me the one I like best is the Seventh-day Adventist. A friend of mine that's an attorney for the Seventh-day Adventist puts out a little book that tells me where the cases are. A court report, and there are others like it, but this is a good one, but he has the one where a review has been granted and where it's been denied and so forth. So it tells me where it's going to be. And the only one that's been decided, of course, is a creation science, a balanced treatment of creation science. That's been decided Supreme Court. Now, secular humanism is a much more complex topic, but they're related to the other two. And the same group of parents, in other words, there's a little difference, but you'll find some interesting coalitions. The Catholics in Louisiana were supporting that creation science law. I have not had a chance to read that opinion yet, but I'll be interested in reading, for instance, Rehnquist, the Chief Justice in the newest appointment, Scalia, voted against that. A 7-2 decision on that issue is a pretty definite commitment to that fact. I happen to personally hold to the majority of the court on that one. But maybe for a different reason. And I think what Rehnquist and Scalia wrote, for which there's some precedent, was based on the fact that if the state had the right to set its curriculum, that the Supreme Court is not necessarily the super school board of the United States. And that's an interesting aspect, as they have been in several cases. So the argument, I'm not sure, but I'm anxious to read Rehnquist and Scalia's dissent. Because William Brennan, wrote the majority opinion, which also is an interesting thing about the Supreme Court at the present time. When the Chief Justice, when the Chief Justice is with majority, then he can set who writes the case. If he's with minority, then the Senior Justice assigns who writes the case. Well, Brennan is writing some very interesting cases right now, and that's one of them that he wrote. In light of that Louisiana is heavily Catholic, and I think supported the creation science position with others, the balanced treatment, and the fact that Scalia is a strong Catholic. So I look at those religious positions and political positions, that's why I said the political aspects of decision making, but I think the 7-2, many have been 5-4 when it comes to religious issues. Now, is secular humanism...
Yeah. Well, don't you think it's real serious, though, when the Supreme Court people are appointed to the idea of supporting the system in the church? And I feel that it is a very dangerous idea.
Well, I guess that's the political aspects of it. It's like the Warren Court, the Roosevelt Court, and so forth. That's one of the areas in which our founding fathers probably did not think it through as carefully.
And I personally wonder if the administration
is a caucus. Yeah, that's an interesting point here. The thing is, the way it is, excuse me, the political realities are that this is the way it exists. And I think unless there is some type of way of changing it constitutionally, that's the way it's going to be in the foreseeable future. I think this one appointment coming up now, the Bork appointment, is going to be, the hearings on that are going to be terribly interesting. But there is one aspect, however. The court has a tendency to follow pretty much a middle path. Even, you know, when they're appointed to that position, they have a tendency to not go so much to the extremes. Because when you read the decisions, there is some consistency to it. I think Rehnquist could say, Berger had a tendency to kind of get the feel of the place and say, well, he'd decide which way he was going to go, and then assign the opinion or assign the writing of the majority. They say Rehnquist is much more of a purist, and they're wanting and is sitting back, where they thought he would take it over and make a lot of those decisions. He is not a purist, as yet. And you say Scalia or Scalia. Scalia. Maybe it's that guy. Scalia. That's scary. I think Scalia. Scalia apparently is a brilliant jurist. Apparently Bork is too. They say Bork's the only brilliant man to come across the pipe, you know. Oliver Wendell Holmes or John Marshall or somebody like that. Fortas. Yeah, Abe Fortas. Yeah. But you see, you've got to be a lawyer and make a living too. So some of those fellows have a tough time when they do that. I don't know. Maybe you want to comment, David, on the whole concept. The reason that secular humanism has been defined as religion, and the reason Hand wrote that is because he wasn't the first judge to decide that. There have been some judges, and McCarthy does write that. Some aspects of that I think quite well, in which he cites some incidents in which other courts have defined secular humanism as a religion. And in fact, there was an amendment to a bill in Congress in 1976 on the title II Reauthorization, which talked about any aspect of the religion of secular humanism. It didn't pass that amendment. And in Pennsylvania, a Pennsylvania court rejected the assertion that the dismissal constitutes hostility towards theism and established secular humanism. In one case, I won't cite any cases. And she goes through and talks about that part. And so, in a sense, like I say, Judge Hand, as much as people criticize him, has come up with a case in which there are some other precedents in terms of the terminology. Most people think that case, well, it was stayed. It has not been carried out, and it's not likely to pass the muster, I think, of the Circuit Court or probably the Supreme Court. But one of the most, the McCarthy, since she's a member of Lutheran Church, she says one of the most troublesome issues facing the courts pertains to what constitutes a religious belief, and therefore subject to establishment clause prohibitions. And, you know, and we look, and I've been in my work as a working private school, I've worked with a lot of interesting communities and cults and so forth. And you look at them, and what are the protections? And what is a religion? I think of one family in Seattle that fell apart, a family called the Love Family. I don't know if you ever heard of it, like Rise Beach in Oregon, a commune. But you know, none of those have been able to hold together. I mean, they have not been able to hold the fabric together. Because they probably are not. Probably not a religion. As, you know, I think the test of religion is probably staying in power. And the Yoder, Wisconsin decision was based on the fact that the old Amish had a long established tradition of a religious practice. But, and the more I look at cults, the more I look at television ministries, I mean, and so the more I love the Lutheran Church. Because I really believe that's a factor. Yes, yeah. Right. That's correct. Right. See, the reason I think that the decision is not bad. Because I think to say creation is a science is not appropriate. I think that's what people are saying, scientific creations. I really don't know what scientific creation is means. I think secular humanism is understandable. We know that. That is, I think, a philosophy based on self. In other words, the human can solve its own problems, and the end all of relying on the human for the source of all knowledge. Whereas in God, we see him as the source of knowledge, whatever that form takes. God is God, as Don Luck said, and Peter Carroll said last night. So my feeling is that if they left the thing alone, you can teach creation as that's a fact of life. You know, one of the empirical facts, I think we can say one of the empirical facts of our society is that 80 to 90% of our people believe in some type of higher power. That's an empirical fact. You know, that's statistic. Now, what they believe and how they believe and where and so forth, and That's another aspect of it. But I have always felt that there is not a... I think we have to acknowledge that a good portion of our students come from homes where there are strongly held beliefs about the origin of the earth. And whatever that creative mind and power accomplished in, during that time, that Genesis, I think is a marvelous description.
Well, don't you think that
I don't think it was either.
People all have an impression, you know, that it's very popular and popular.
Yeah. That's right. I think that was what was so bad about it. They the newspaper, I'd have to say the media probably does that because it is news to say you can't pray in the public school anymore. That isn't what it said. And I don't believe this case says that you can't teach about creation in the public school. It says you can't make creation a science. And the judges in their wisdom have viewed that. And what, as you say, what Rehnquist and Scalia have done, because they represent a more traditional, fundamental view of the Constitution, they're saying if the state says that's all right for the school curriculum, that's a state right which is not, which is a power that was given to them under the Constitution to make the determinations about school reform. Because there's a Christian humanism.
Yeah.
I mean, he was Christ. Christ is both God and man, and so you cannot deny the humanism of Christ. When you get into this, then you have, and this is why I think, you know, even creationism. I have a hard time with even the term creationism, because I think of communism and totalitarianism and all these isms, and I'm not interested too much in the isms. What I'm interested is in that fact. That I believe there is a fact of creation. The fact is told in a story in Genesis, and I don't think that is critical to those. And I think if people would leave that alone, they could have followed in that pattern. I don't think they had to do this process of testing that area. And of course, I think public schools have a tendency sometimes to look at something without looking at the freedom they have, the academic freedom we have as teachers, the academic freedom we have in schools to teach all aspects of knowledge.